Of course, President Trump has disavowed this. But meanwhile, the director of Project 2025, Paul Danz, a former top advisor in Trump's administration, has been forced to step down. And of course, that book, which is headed by the head of Heritage Foundation, which is behind this blueprint, is now they are putting off the publication of this with the foreword by none other than Trump's vice presidential running mate, J.D. Vance.
The Trump campaign has clearly come to the realization that Project 2025 and the policies that it lays out are extremely unpopular. And it's not really surprising to understand why. Just a few of those policies are, for instance, closing the entire Department of Education, further restricting abortion rights in this country, especially the mifepristone, also known as the abortion pill, slashing Medicaid, and then, of course, reclassifying tens of thousands of career government employees so that they can be more easily fired and then replaced by more loyal, vetted political appointees chosen by the next conservative president, which, again, in this case, would potentially be Donald Trump. So there's a reason the Trump campaign is distancing itself from those unpopular policies. It is hurting their campaign. However, as you pointed out, and as we report in our story, the number of connections between Trump's political operation and his administration from 17 to 21 in Project 2025 are many, as we write in the story. Of the 36 different speakers in these videos, 29 of them have a connection to Mr. Trump. They worked in his administration across the government, the White House, National Security Council, a number of departments, including Justice, Interior, Health and Human Services, Office of Management and Budget, Presidential Personnel Office, across the board. There are people who ran his 2016-17 transition team that led him into the first presidency. And lastly, I would point out the Trump reelection campaign spokeswoman who sent us a comment reiterating in their view that there's no connection between 2025 and the Trump campaign. She herself, Carolyn Leavitt, actually appears in the videos that we posted on our site. So it's really impossible to say that there is some bright line here between Trump's political campaign, his team, and this Project 2025 effort.
Andy Kroll, I want to play a series of clips that you have just released. This is another Project 2025 training video featuring Katie Sullivan, who was acting Assistant Attorney General at Department of Justice under Trump. In this clip, Sullivan says the next conservative administration will need to eradicate all equity plans.
I think you can expect that equity and all of the equity executive orders under Biden will be repealed early in the next administration. This is going to require a very detailed plan to execute the eradication of the dictates in the equity orders. For instance, there's a gender advisor position created by one of these executive orders. That position has to be eradicated, as well as all the task forces, the removal of all the equity plans from all the websites, and a complete rework of the language in internal and external policy documents and grant applications.
And this is another Project 2025 training video featuring Dan Huff, former legal advisor in the White House Presidential Personnel Office under Trump, laying out how political appointees should be ready to enforce dramatic changes and face blowback when they do.
If the next Republican president does not execute a dramatic course correction, there may never be another chance. So if you're not on board with helping implement a dramatic course correction because you're afraid it'll damage your future employment prospects, it'll harm you socially. Look, I get it. That's a real danger. It's a real thing. But please, do us all a favor and sit this one out.
And this is another Project 2025 training video titled The Political Appointees Survival Guide. It features Max Pomerantz, a former deputy administrator at USAID during the Trump administration.
Now, in terms of a tip, survival tip, do not let career bureaucrats hinder you from advancing the president's agenda. Keep in mind, you're coming into a place, Washington, D.C., that does not share your conservative values. They're even hostile to it. Because you're here to do something that's not in their interest. They're not going to be your friend, and they're not going to help you succeed. What are you doing? You're here to cut government. You're here to cut spending. You're here to cut regulations. You're here to stop the waste, fraud, and abuse that's going on. But a lot of careers have been made from that. A lot of money has been made from that. Fiefdoms have been built around it. So you're going to get a lot of opposition here. It's an entire industry of opposition from lobbyists, professional associations, contractor groups, and disappointingly, faith-based organizations.
And finally, I want to turn to a Project 2025 training video featuring Alexei Walternist, a former Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs at the Department of Homeland Security. In this video, he encourages future appointees to avoid mainstream news outlets like The New York Times, The Washington Post. Instead, take their message to conservative media.
The American people who vote for a conservative presidential administration, they're not reading The New York Times. They're not reading The Washington Post. Actually, to the contrary. If those outlets publish something, they're going to assume it's false. So the only way to reach them with any voice of credibility is through working with conservative media outlets.
So Andy Kroll, investigative reporter for ProPublica, if you can respond, this is just an excerpt of the videos that you have released inside Project 2025's secret training videos.
Yeah, I would pull out a couple of key points for your audience, Amy. I would say first that there is a level of extreme rhetoric in these videos, even down to the choice of words in these different clips. We hear the word eradicate a lot, and then we hear eradicate in the context of removing the word climate change from any federal government document that a future appointee sees. Obviously, that would not move the country in the right direction in terms of combating this existential threat that we face with climate change. You hear eradicate in terms of getting rid of policies that are responding to gender inequality, racial inequality. I mean, those executive actions that Katie Sullivan in the second clip discussed, you know, those are things responding to the abuses surfaced by the Me Too movement or the abuses surfaced, the injustices surfaced in 2020 and during the racial uprisings then as well. Getting rid of all of those. And then you have, with this last clip, the former DHS press secretary, you have someone basically saying, when you get into government, just talk to conservative media. Shut out everybody else. I mean, mainstream media, but just about everyone else as well. Only talk to the people who you agree with, who like you. That the audiences served by those conservative outlets are the only ones that matter. That's not what a presidential administration, Democratic or Republican, is supposed to do. You're supposed to serve the whole country. But clearly, that is not the advice that they're getting in these clips.
It's very interesting that they advise the right-wing administration not to leave a paper trail, yet they have left quite a video trail. As we wrap up, Andy, the most important takeaways at this point.
Yeah, the most important takeaways, I think, for people watching are the first time that Trump ran and then, surprisingly to many, got elected, his operation was very unprepared. They did not have a bench of people ready. There was chaos. There was confusion. And that set back that administration for perhaps months, maybe even a year or two into the Trump first administration. If he is elected again, that will not be the case. These videos have a lot of extreme content in them, a lot of eyebrow-raising advice, for instance, like don't leave a paper trail, which you just referenced. But really what they are trying to do is prepare these thousands or tens of thousands of people to get in government and enact a pretty conservative, a right-wing agenda and be prepared and trained to do it from the moment that administration starts. That is different from before. And the voting public needs to understand that when they think about these two candidates, when they think about what that Trump agenda would be if he gets elected in November and takes office in January.
Andy Kroll, we want to thank you so much for being with us, investigative reporter for ProPublica. His new expose titled Inside Project 2025 Secret Training Videos. ProPublica has posted the full 23 videos totaling more than 14 hours of content on its website. We will link to it. Coming up, the Summer Olympics held its closing ceremony in Paris Sunday. We'll look at some of the controversies over the 2024 Summer Games. And as the Paralympics is set to start later this month, we'll speak with the Palestinian Paralympian from Gaza, disabled since he was shot by an Israeli soldier in Gaza City in 2001. Stay with us. Now by the French heavy metal band Gojira. It was the Paris Olympics opening act. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The 2024 Summer Olympics in Paris held its closing ceremony Sunday with actor Tom Cruise jumping from the stadium roof and passing the baton to Los Angeles, which will host the next games in 2028. The mayor of Los Angeles was there, Karen Best, and she promised to try to make L.A. car-free for those Olympics. At the first ever Olympic breakdancing competition of the games, a member of the Olympic refugee team from Afghanistan, known as B-Girl Talash, was disqualified when she wore a cape that said Free Afghan Women. The International Olympic Committee also allowed France to ban hijab-wearing Olympians from France in what critics called a shameful moment. But the games ended with the Dutch runner, Stefan Hassan, becoming a record-breaking Olympic marathon gold medalist and wearing a hijab during the ceremony when she accepted her medal. Meanwhile, the Algerian boxer, Iman Khalif, won the Olympic gold medal Friday in a major victory for the athlete who competed while facing a torrent of abuse, fed in part by harassment from high-profile transphobic observers, including Donald Trump and author J.K. Rowling, who falsely claimed Khalif was a trans athlete and should be banned from competing. Khalif has since filed a legal complaint in France against online harassment. Her attorney posted on Instagram Friday, quote, Iman Khalif has decided to lead a new fight, that of justice, dignity, and honor, unquote. Also at the games, American sprinter Noah Lyles won gold for 100-meter dash, later had to leave the games after he collapsed and had to be rolled away from the track. When he finished third, won bronze in the 200-meter dash, and it was revealed he tested positive for COVID. Many of the athletes came down with COVID there. All of this comes as French authorities face protests for systematically displacing unhoused people in Paris. Later this month, the Paralympics start on August 28th. For more, we're joined by three guests. In Paris, we're joined by Fedi Dib, representing Palestine as a shot putter in the 2024 Paris Olympics, the only member of the Palestinian Olympic delegation from Gaza, the only Paralympian athlete from Palestine to compete in the 2024 Summer Games. He's been disabled since he was shot by an Israeli soldier in Gaza City in 2001. Just back from Paris is Dave Zirin, who's covered the Olympics as sports editor for The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast. Also with us, Shireen Ahmed, senior contributor to CBC Sports and instructor of sports journalism and media at Toronto Metropolitan University. Your most recent article is headlined Afghan Athletes DQ Shows IOC Support of Women is Not Unconditional. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Dave, you're just back from Paris. Can you talk about the highlights and lowlights of these Olympics?
Well, Amy, it's great to be here. It's an honor to be on with Fadi, who I got to meet in Paris. And of course, it's terrific to be on with my dear friend Shireen. First of all, I got to start with the lowlights. I heard a reporter in Paris say, why aren't there any stories away from the Olympics? Why aren't there any stories in Paris? And that really got me upset, because there are 12,500 stories in Paris if people just wanted to investigate them. 12,500 is the number of migrants and the number of unhoused people who are unceremoniously loaded on buses and driven outside the city and dropped off in shelters or just dropped off, period. And one of the things I heard when I was there is they prioritized women and children for these trips outside the city. And of course, I put trips in ironic quotes. And they, because they prioritize women and children, they also broke up families in Paris for the purposes of making the city, as they say, you know, acceptable and clean for the games for a foreign audience of wealthy tourists. So that part of it was extremely distressing. If you want to talk about a positive, I think there's a warning sign for Los Angeles in the 2028 Olympics, because the positive part of Paris is that it's a highly centralized city with a first-class European public transportation system. Fast forward to Los Angeles in 2028, where it looks like the metro system's not even going to be built. And also, as we know in Los Angeles, there's a serious unhoused problem. We've seen the governor, Gavin Newsom, personally put a hand in displacing unhoused people. We have to start organizing now to make sure that the 2028 Olympics in Los Angeles are not a carnival of injustice.
And let's talk about some of the athletes and the stories around them. Let me bring into this conversation Shireen Ahmed. You know, as we watch the closing ceremony, tens of thousands of people crowded into the stadium, Shireen, the Netherlands' Sifan Hassan had her record-breaking moment where she was holding the gold. She was honored for the marathon. The women's marathon was the last marathon and the last sport before the ending of the Olympics. And Sifan Hassan stood there, podium gold, in her hijab. Talk about why this was so significant in this final moment.
Amy, the irony and sort of the bittersweet ending to these Olympics was so poignantly displayed by Sifan Hassan. So the thing is, she doesn't actually compete with hijab on. She chooses to wear it when she chooses to wear it, but she chose it to wear it in this moment. And it was, I can't speak for her, and I'm not sure what her intention was, but the statement was most definitely made. I mean, to accept one of the biggest honors, the last medal ceremony, and you know, in a host nation that literally violently prevents Black and brown Muslim women who choose to wear hijab from sport, and people, and I think that's one of the most underreported stories of these games as well, was the fact that this host nation who claims to participate and be part of this Olympics of gender parity, which is really hypocritical because they don't even allow their own Olympians, French Olympians who are Muslim women and want to wear hijab, cannot. So the fact that that happened was just, it was remarkable. It was a remarkable moment, and it was a very beautiful and quiet message to women all around the world, and particularly those in France who are prevented from participating at a local, recreational, you know, provincial, or even, you know, in national programs. And I work with an organization and follow them and report on them called Basket pour Toutes, and which is basketball for all is the translation. And the fact that that moment was done, I mean, the you know, the conversations were fluttering. One of the things that I found heartening, Amy, was that it was being commented on in that narrative, which is really important because, again, this is a story that French media didn't actually want to pick up because it's shameful. As you mentioned earlier, it's embarrassing and it's hypocritical. You can't profess to support all women when you're being selective in that support.
Now, Dave Zirin, I wanted to go to that incredible moment, the all-Black award podium of gymnasts. The Brazilian gymnast, Rebeca Andrade, And the U.S. gymnasts, Simone Biles and Jordan Chiles, made history last week as they accepted their medals for the first ever all-black podium in either men's or women's gymnastics. Simone Biles has won 3 golds and a silver in Paris, making her the most decorated U.S. gymnast in Olympic history. This incredible moment when Biles and Chiles bows down to Andrade, who took home the gold despite competing with 3 torn ACLs. That was last week's news. And now you have the latest where the Olympic Committee has ruled that Jordan Chiles must return her bronze medal in the women's floor exercise after a court of arbitration for sports ruling. In an update on August 11th, the International Olympic Committee sided with the ruling, confirming she could no longer be the bronze medalist. But the U.S. is appealing this. Explain it all.
Well, first and foremost, with regards to Jordan Chiles, this is a terrible injustice for somebody who performed at her best and earned that medal. Now, there's also a discussion of them sharing the medal, but the IOC nixed that right away. So here's Jordan Chiles and her people stepping forward with this idea that is in the so-called, quote-unquote, Olympic spirit. You know, and frankly, in the spirit of Biles and Chiles doing the bow to Andrade, like this idea, this beautiful feeling of communal cooperation about people, what you, the Olympics is supposed to be about raising their level of performance. And instead to come down on Chiles like this, it leaves such a bitter sweet taste in one's mouth. And frankly, I'm reminded of a story 1968 Olympian Dr. John Carlos told me, where he talked about how after he won his bronze medal and then he raised his fist on the medal stand, the International Olympic Committee showed up in his hotel room and demanded that he return the medal. And John Carlos' response was to say, "Well, where are they?" And they looked at him quizzically and said, "Where are who?" And John Carlos said, "The army that you are going to need to take this medal from me." I mean, I hope that there is a similar result to this where Jordan Chiles goes home and wears that medal proudly from her neck. If that's a shared prospect, terrific. If that's hers, terrific. But the idea of stripping it from her after such a beautiful moment, in an odd way, it speaks to the very contradictions of the Olympics themselves.
Dave, introduce our next guest to us, because you wrote a wonderful piece in The Nation about Fadi Deeb representing Palestine as shot putter in the 2024 Paralympics.
Well, you're giving me chills just by asking me the question. Fadi Deeb is one of the incredible people I met in Paris and one of the incredible people I've met in all my years doing sports writing, a terrific Paralympian, a terrific representative of the Palestinian people and his home area of Gaza. And I'd like to give the floor to him so his voice can be heard at the moment.
So, Fadi, you have a split screen right now. Dave's back in Washington. You're there in Paris, where you're going to be competing in the next 2 weeks. Can you tell us your story? You represent Palestine in the Paralympics. Talk about how you became disabled, what it means to represent Palestine, and talk about your sport, shot put.
First of all, good evening for you. Good evening for Dav and it's my pleasure to be with you in the one of the biggest show in the world and to speak about my story, about my country, about Palestine. My name is Fadi Aldeeb. I'm as a Palestinian from Gaza Strip in the east of Gaza. My neighborhood is Shijaiya area in the east of Gaza. 2000, in the 4th of October 2001, I get my disability in the second intifada. I get shot in my back from the Israeli sniper. So this is what happened with me, and I get my disability from 2001 up to now. To be a player and to compete in this competition for the Paris 2024 is something like give me like too much responsibility to talk about my country, to show the people about Palestine. It's not just war. It's not just blood. There is life. There is hopes. There is goals. There is dreams. So I get a message. First of all, I want to raise my country flag here in Paris and to show the people we are still here. We're still in life. We have hopes. We have dreams. We have goals. And to send message for all of the world about our life as a players, as an athlete. Yeah.
Fadi, can you talk about your family now in Gaza? I understand that you have lost a number of members of your family.
It's a very hard situation to make a balance between my sport as an international player and one who is want to come to compete in the Paralympic Games. And at the same time, my family, my sisters, my brothers is instilling Gaza Strip. To give you these feelings is very hard to focus about what I'm doing. As example, my family is look like now four group to celebrate as a four groups, because if there is one group is attacked, still the second group and the third group is still in life. Because everyone, there is no safe place in Gaza Strip, and everyone is like a target for the killing machine. So what is happening now is it's a genocide. It's not a war. It's like a genocide. My family, it's have a bad situation. The same of the all of the Palestinian in Gaza Strip. I lose my brother in the 7th of December 2023, and two of my nephew also too, and for whole of my family member, I lose more than 17 person. So the situation is very hard. It's too much hard to focus about my sport, and my feelings is and my heart is in my country, and what I'm watching in the news and hearing in the news about the blood, about bombed, about attacked. So everything in Gaza Strip is like a target. So you don't. There is no difference between you as a sportsman or like a doctor or engineering, or there is no difference between homes or hospital or anything. So just to be have the nationality of as a Palestinian, so it's like a reason for the machine to be like a enemy and to attack you. So this is the situation in Gaza Strip now.
According to Save the Children, more than 10 children per day in Gaza have lost one or both of their legs since Israel began its assault on October. Can you talk about the amputation crisis in this last minute we have, speaking to us from Paris?
Normally, as we are in Gaza Strip, 2,300,000 persons in Gaza Strip. So we talk about more than 120,000 people with disability. And in the last war and in the last genocide, what happened now in Gaza Strip, we talk about more than 10,000 new people with disability in the last genocide. Children, women and men, and they have an amputee and paraplegic. So it's a very hard situation because there is, as I told before, there is no difference between any, if you are children or woman, so everyone is a target. What I want to explain for you, it's in the same time, it's a very hard situation. And also, as example, we are as a people with disability in our sport. So we are training before this genocide as a in our sport.
Fadi, we're going to have to wrap up the conversation now, but we're going to continue. Fadi Deeb represents Palestine as a shot putter in the 2024 Paralympics, which begin later this month. The only member of the Palestinian Olympic delegation from Gaza. And I want to thank Ashrin Ahmed and Dave Zirin. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
Hello. This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.
You're listening.